Bam.
I need three volunteers. Can I get three volunteers? Come on. It's not going to hurt, okay? Mr. David Alderman, I need two more. It's not going to hurt. I'm telling you. There's a fan up here, but you don't stick your tongue in the fan. So I need another volunteer. Come on. I need two more. This isn't going to work if I just have David. David, go ahead. You can come on all the way up here and pick your own seat. Pick your own seat. I'm serious. It's not going to hurt. Okay, Mr. Roger over here and Dean. All right, come on up. Get on up here. You guys, find your seats, and this is what I want you to do, okay? I know this is going to sound insanely weird, because hopefully it is weird. Hopefully you've never done this before. If you have done this before, I feel weird for you. Okay, so David, you get the handheld one, and you'll see this one has a switch right up at the top to turn it on, okay? So when we're ready, you can turn that thing on. And then you guys, I'm going to just go ahead and turn these on now, because, you know, Roger always wants a fan anyway. So you're going to have to, like, lean into this. Okay, so there's that. Secondly, I'm going to give each one, this is for later. Don't worry about that. Secondly, I'm going to give you each a paper towel here, and you're going to just want to hold on to this paper towel, like in your lap or in front of you or maybe, you know, somewhere nearby where you can easily access it. Here you go. There's some paper for you. There you go. And then each one of you gets a cup. So we'll set that one there. Here you go. There's a cup right there. There's a cup right there, and there's a cup right there. Okay, this is what we're going to do, okay? What I want you guys to do is I want you to stick your tongues out as far as you can, then close your mouth on it, on your tongue. You know, don't bite it or anything, but just close your mouth on it. And then lean into the fan and dry your tongue. Can you do that? Okay. So huge, man. That's insane. But yeah, that's impressive. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay, so close your lips. You got to get your lips closed on your tongue. So stick it way out. Lips closed on your tongue, and then just run the fan. Yeah, just run the fan. Lean in there and get it all dried off. Okay. Meanwhile, I'm going to review with you where we've been over the last couple of weeks. See, we started this series called BAM because Emeril Lagasse has taught us that when you season food, you need to say BAM when you hit it with the salt or the spices or whatever it is. And we've been studying this passage that Jesus taught us from Matthew chapter 5 to try to play out what this is going to look like in our lives. And the passage will be up on your screen. It's Matthew 5:13. If you have a note sheet, you're going to want to pull that out. Get ready to take some notes. If you didn't grab a Bible earlier, I'm serious. You got to go back there and get one because we're reading a long section today. But here's this passage. You're the salt of the earth, Jesus says, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. And so we've been talking about what it means to be salt. 2 weeks ago, we learned this lesson that because Jesus says we're salt, what that really means is it means that we are the source of the world's greatest blessing. We're the source of the world's greatest blessing. And then last week we learned that unsalty Christians or Christians who don't bless others are worthless to the world. How you guys doing back here? Yeah. All right. Keep it going. You guys are doing well. Okay. Today you're going to learn the most difficult lesson you will ever learn in your entire life. But before we get to that, we have to do a little bit of a science experiment. And that's what these guys behind us are doing. I want to show you something. I've brought, how dry is your tongue, guys? Don't talk because, you know, that'll open your mouth and get it all wet again. But raise your hand and touch your tongue with one of your fingers. Just say, hey, is it pretty dry? Pretty dry? Okay. So, yeah. All right. So hopefully it's dry enough for this experiment to work. But this is what we're going to do. I've got some salt here. And what I'm going to do is now, they look worried, don't they? Aren't you glad you didn't volunteer? Okay, so now what I want you guys to do, if it's dry enough, let's go ahead and lean back, keep that tongue going, doing its thing, okay? Lean back just a little bit, and I'm gonna put some salt on your tongues, all right? And here's the thing. I want you to, like, raise your hand. I want you to pay attention to the salt and really ask yourself this question, can I taste it? Okay? I'm going to start over here with Dean. Just avoid some of these things. Okay, so lean your head back just a little bit. Okay. How's it going? You all right? Okay. Let's try David down here. Lean your head back just a little bit. Let's see if this works. Okay, one more. How you doing there? Okay. Guys doing all right there? Now, what I want you to do is raise your hand and tell me from 1 to 5 how much you can taste the salt. 1 is very little, and 5 is you can taste it pretty well. 1, 3, 2. Okay. What we're going to do here, though, is I brought some water, and here's the turkey baster. Okay, you got your spit cup there, okay? And you got your towel there, okay? We're just gonna put a couple drops of water right on top of your tongue here, and then I'm all shaky for you. I'm like nervous. Here we go. Are you ready? Mm-hmm. Woo! How's that going now? Okay, you can get rid of all that if you want. Let's see what Rogers goes to.
Can I get a laughing?
Yes. How's that going for you, Roger? Has it reached a 5 yet? Has it reached a 5? Yeah, you're 4, okay. Here we go, Dean. Lean your head back just a little bit. We'll squirt your face all over there. Okay, how's that going for you? Is that a 5 yet? Yeah, it's pretty. You guys can spit. Go ahead. Get rid of all that. Let's give these guys a hand. And just... Cheers. There you go. Thanks so much. So tell me real quick, before you go, Roger, tell me real quick. Compare the one without any water to the one with water.
Well, you could just take a slight taste of the salt.
Uh-huh.
It must have been some of the areas that weren't completely dry.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, when you added the further... Kicked it in
pretty good. Yeah, and Dave's back now. How you doing, man? You survive? All right, let's give him another hand. Unsalty water, that's good. Okay, so here's the deal. I want to teach you a chemistry lesson today about salt. Did you know your tongue can't taste salt? It can't. It can only taste... Here you go. Are you ready? High school chemistry coming back at you. It can only taste the ions that salt is made of. Salt is made of 2 ions. It's made of sodium. It's made of chlorine. And sodium is a positive ion, and chlorine is a negative ion. And what happens is because one is positive and one is negative, like a magnet, they stick together. And so when they have the opportunity to, they'll stick together. And so when water dries out and there's salt in the water, when water dries out, these molecules get close to each other, and then when the water dries out, they stick together. And you've got salt, you've got sodium chloride. But your tongue can't taste the chlorine. Your tongue is only able to taste the sodium, and it can only taste the sodium when it is all by itself, and it's an ion, and it gets into one of your taste buds, and it makes you taste. It's the same mechanism that you can taste acid or sour things from. Salt works the same way. But here's another chemistry lesson for you. Another chemistry lesson is that when salt is in water, the ions split. Do you realize when you have salty water, you don't actually have salt in the water? What you have is you have a whole bunch of sodium ions and you have a whole bunch of chlorine ions, and they're all just swishing around in there. None of them are stuck together. They're all just swishing around in there. It's only when the water dries out that we get what we call salt, which is sodium chloride that comes together. There's your chemistry lesson for the day, but here's where it applies to you and me. There's a blank. You can jot this down on your note sheet if you want. Salt only works when it loses itself for a greater cause. Salt only works when it loses itself for a greater cause. If you have a dry tongue and the salt is still salt, it's still stuck together, it's still in a clump, it's not going to do any work. But when the water splits it up into the different parts of it, then it can do work, then you can taste it, then you can run to the bathroom and spit it all out. But salt needs to die in order for it to do its work. Today you're going to learn the most difficult lesson you will ever learn. But before we get to that, I have to take you to another passage, the one right after Jesus talks about salt. In Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 14, we see the next thing Jesus said to his followers. It's on your note sheet. It'll be on the screen too. Jesus says this, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house." You're the light of the world. People put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. You know, we, for the past couple of weeks, have been trying to motivate you and encourage you to realize that if you're salt, that means you're the source of the world's greatest blessing. That means you're the one who can bring amazing blessing to the people of this world. That's something that should make you feel really encouraged, really inspired, really, really glad to be who you are and glad to know Jesus. And now he goes one step further and he says, you're the light of the world. And everybody knows that light is something you want to put on a pedestal so it can shine everywhere. And I think a lot of us take this mentality that says, listen, Jesus says I'm the light. You know what that means? That means it's okay for me to think that I should be on a pedestal. That means that I am the one the world needs to see. That means that you need to recognize me for the salty and light person that I am. That means the whole world needs, Christians should be the most popular, most well-loved, richest, most significant, most pretty or handsome, the most celebrity, the most famous of all the people on the world, right? Because God wants his light to shine. Sometimes we get that picture in our minds, but real life doesn't work that way. Real life is more like you're at the bottom of the totem pole that is your career. And every step you climb up, it seems like someone else stabs you in the back and skips a step above you. Maybe you've experienced some other kind of tragedy or pain or hardship in your life, and you ask the question, God, why? Why would you let your children suffer like that? Why would you let me? I'm supposed to be the light to the world. I'm supposed to be the salt to the world. Why would you let me go through these difficult times? And why would you call me to make sacrifices? The rest of the world should be making sacrifices to get to know me because I'm the one with the light. The real world doesn't work the way we want the real world to work. See, we think of salt and light completely backwards. We think that because I'm the salt, that means I should get the benefits of the salt. Salt is valuable. Salt is flavorful. Salt has preservative effects. That means I should be preserved. That means I should get flavor in my life. That means I should be considered valuable by everybody. I'm salt. That means I should experience the benefits of being salt. I'm light. That means I should experience the benefits of being light. Everybody should recognize me. But the truth is, salt needs to die to do its work. Salt needs to lose itself for a greater cause in order to get its work done. And light? Light only does its job when it's put in a place of darkness. If you take a candle outside at broad daylight, that candle's doing nothing. If you take your light into a place of brightness, you're not doing anything. But when light gets to a place of darkness, then it can do something. Go ahead and write that down. A light is only good if it's put in a place of darkness. See, one last thing here. We want to live for us, but Jesus calls us to live from us. Jesus says, I'm giving you salt, I'm giving you light, and now I want you to live from that for the world. Don't live for yourself. Live from what Jesus is giving to you for the world. Today, you are going to learn the most difficult lesson you ever will learn. But before we do that, we're going to go to 2 Corinthians and take one more look at this light passage from a different angle. Because when the Apostle Paul found out that he was the container of God's light, he reacted pretty severely to that. 2 Corinthians, it's in the Bibles we pass out, it's on page 802. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, we're going to pick it up in verse 6. So go there if you would. We're going to pick it up in verse 6. The Apostle Paul says, "For God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Next week, Pastor Reggie is going to be preaching on verses 1 through 6. He's got this passage here. But I wanted to draw out that context for us so we could see this is Paul realizing that the God who said, "Let there be light," is the same God who put his light into you and into me and into him. And Paul says, that God has given me light. But check out what the next verse says. He says, but we have this treasure, this light, in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. See, Paul is recognizing this incredible paradox. This paradox that God, the source of all light, would take his light and put it in fragile people like us. Paul calls himself a jar of clay. I mean, that's like if you take a Fabergé egg, you know, one of these really ornate, elaborate, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars worth of decorated eggs. I think it's insane that they even have these things. But nonetheless, they're there. And people have made these things, and they're elaborate, and they're ornate, and they cost lots and lots and lots of money. And you take one of those Fabergé eggs, and you put it in a Ziploc bag. That's like what God is doing to you. He's taking his light, he's putting it into you. It's like taking the Mona Lisa and putting it in the trunk of your car. It's like feeding caviar and truffles to an infant. It's like putting a treasure in a jar made of clay. Paul says, this paradox is too weird for me. And so then he begins to expand and explain how much a jar of clay he feels like. And what this light is doing in him and through him. And so as a result, we're going to learn today the most difficult lesson we ever will learn. And we're almost there. But to do it, we have to go all the way to the end of this passage and work backwards. Jump with me down to verse 16. In verse 16, Paul says this, "Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we're wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." Paul says, I don't lose heart, even though outwardly I'm just a jar. Outwardly, I'm just made of mud. Outwardly, I'm wasting away. Outwardly, I'm nothing. Inwardly, I'm being renewed. Inwardly, I've got light. Inwardly, I'm a person of salt, he could say. He says, inwardly, I'm being renewed day by day. Now, you and I say things similar to this. Okay, someone might come up to you and they'd be like, hey, Jim, how's your day going? And you're like, well, I'm plugging away still, I'm making do. My marriage is kind of messed up, and my car's in the shop, and my kid is sick, but every day is a new day, so I'm still hanging in there. The next day, hey Jim, how you doing? Or maybe this is a different Jim. Hey Bob, maybe it's Bob. Hey Bob, how you doing? I'm doing okay, I'm still plugging away. You know, my iPod is messed up. My Mercedes is in the shop, and, my goldfish is sick. But every day is a new day. I'm still hanging in there. And you're like, what? And then so you talk to Steve, and you're like, hey, Steve, how you doing today? And he's like, well, I'm all right. I'm hanging in there. You know, my toenail is still messed up, and my Amazon shipment is still in the shop. Hasn't gotten here yet. And by the way, you know, Kim Kardashian was sick on last week's episode. So, but I'm doing all right. Every day is a new day. I'm still hanging in there. We do stuff like this all the time so we can sound like we're doing all right, so we can sound like we're strong. What we do is we come up with bad things in our lives. If someone asks you how you're doing, you'll run through all the list of things that are bad before you say, oh, I'm fine. And internally, what you're doing is you're saying, despite all the crud in my life, like the reality show that I like to watch being off air or having some problems or Charlie Sheen's not coming back to 2.5 Men and criminy, how am I going to survive now? You know, we come up with all these kinds of bad things and then we feel good about ourselves that we're enduring them, right? We come up with all these sorts of fake bad things. Well, for the Apostle Paul, it was different. Now, I don't know what it is for you. I'm sure many of us here in this room have gone through some pretty dark times. Many of us in this room maybe are going through a dark time right now. But if you want to see what Paul was thinking when he said these words, we're going to stay in the same book, but we're going to flip a couple chapters over. Go to 11, 2 Corinthians 11. And find verse 24. Paul says, 2 Corinthians 11:24, five times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. That's what you and I would call flogging. That's what Jesus got right before he was crucified. 39 lashes. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. And, oh, by the way, when he says stoned, he meant with rocks. Okay? He meant with rocks. Just so we're clear. Three times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak? And I don't feel weak. Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? Paul is describing there what he has been through up until this point. And at this point, he still hasn't faced his final trial of being in Rome and facing Caesar and eventually being killed for his beliefs. He's not even there yet. Right now, he's just telling us about the stuff that's happened so far. Five times he's been flogged. Once he was stoned, which, by the way, if you don't remember, is to kill people. So now if you go back to where we just were in chapter 4, go to verse 17 and see what he says here. He says, "For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all." Light and momentary? Paul, how can you say that? What's light about a bunch of rocks being hurled at your head? How can you possibly call that light? I mean, these are big, these people were skilled in the art of stoning others to death. They knew how to do it. It wasn't like Paul was their first experience on this. They would pick up the biggest rocks they could, and it wasn't about just hitting someone with a baseball pitch. It was about lugging big rocks and hurling them onto people, biggest rocks you could get, as close to the head as you could get. So Paul is being pelted with rocks in the head. He's being pelted with rocks all around his body, and he's got boulders being heaved onto him, as big as they could get, being chucked at him. Those are heavy, not light. But Paul's saying it happened to him in the past, and he's still writing. See, if you know the story, what happened is that Paul was taken out to the outskirts of the town, and they stoned him, and they thought he was dead. He was there lying on the ground, unconscious. As far as they could tell, he wasn't breathing. As far as they knew, his heart wasn't beating. They all went back into the city, and then somehow, miraculously, God woke him up. And then you know what that weirdo did? He stood up out of the pile of rocks and walked back into the city. Of course, just so you know, if anybody tries to kill you, and then leaves you for dead, and then you're really not dead, and you stand back up, when you talk to them again, they're probably going to pay attention. It's going to be a little bit different, but I don't know. But Paul stood up, and he walks back into the city. So these were heavy rocks, but apparently they weren't heavy enough to keep him down. So yeah, maybe you could say they were light, and they didn't kill him. What about the flogging, okay? That's a pretty serious issue. How can you call that momentary? Time doesn't go faster when you're going through hard times, okay? When you're being stoned, time doesn't fly. No one says time flies when you're being flogged. No one says that. It just doesn't, because when you're being flogged, every moment, every second is painful. These are like this whip with lashes on the end, and the whip lashes had little bits of stone and rock and steel and iron and glass embedded in them. And many of you saw The Passion of the Christ. You know what that was all about. Paul got that 5 times. So that means 39 lashes. Every time he got flogged, he got 39 of those lashes, and they're taking this big whip with all these like lashes at the end of it, and they're just whack, whack. Wait a minute. 39 of those, that take about 10 minutes. Granted, 10 minutes of torture, but 10 minutes. If that happened 5 times in his life, that's 50 minutes. Every time that happens, he would have been bloody, he would have been wounded, he would have been weak, he would have been near death. It would have taken him days to recover, 7, maybe 14 days. And then he'd have scars for the rest of his life. But you know what? Back in his day, the rest of your life wasn't really always that long. So we're talking between 20, maybe 40 years of scars. 50 minutes of torture. 10 total weeks of recovery, 40 years of scars, compared to an eternity of God saying, you did a good job? Yeah, that's momentary. If you take this perspective on your suffering, on your pain, on your issues, your life will be different. But what's even more important is that Paul wasn't talking about a perspective here. He wasn't talking about just getting yourself into a mindset that says these things are light and momentary. He wasn't talking about fooling yourself into saying as they're flogging you, oh, it's not going to last very long. It's not going to hurt very much. He's not talking about fooling yourself. He's saying, listen, these things really are light. They really are momentary. And if he can say that about flogging and stoning and all the stuff he went through, how much more can we say that about the stuff we go through? Paul says it really is light, it really is momentary, and then look at the rest of that verse. He says it's light and momentary, and it's achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. We don't use glory a lot, and so I'm going to define that word for you. There's some blanks on your note sheet, you can write this down. Glory in the original language meant weighty. But because of all the things associated with the weight of gold and the weight of other valuable things, it carried on these other meanings as well. It means wonderful. It means weighty. It means beautiful. It means significant. It means all these different things. And so when Paul says he is achieving a glory for himself, he's saying, I'm achieving something wonderful. I'm achieving something weighty, something important, something significant, something beautiful. All of my hardships are leading to something beautiful. And so here we finally get to the hardest lesson you'll ever learn. And it's phrased this way. Christian suffering leads to glory. Write that down. Christian suffering leads to glory. Now I'm talking about Christian suffering here. I'm not talking about you just feeling bad. I'm talking about the uniquely Christian response to suffering. And it's Christian if it's patterned after our Savior, Jesus. He was brought before the elders and the chief priests of the city, and they accused him with lies. They said all kinds of nasty things about him. And you know what he did? He kept his mouth shut. They asked him a direct question. Do you represent God? Are you the Son of God? And he says, I am. They took him out to be flogged, and he went. They took him up the mountain, and he carried a cross. They hammered nails in his hands and his feet, and he said, Father, forgive them. Suffering as a Christian is uniquely different from the way the rest of the world views hardship. The world as a whole views hardship as something I must avoid or fight against. And yet Christian suffering is something different. Christian suffering is where you embrace the hardship that comes because something greater is coming on the other side. where you embrace the life of salt that loses itself for a greater cause, where you embrace the life of light that says, I'm in the darkness, that's where I'm supposed to be, where you embrace the hardship because glory is coming. If you go to a sports club, they will tell you no pain, no gain. And you'll say, all right, I'm going to go ahead and push these weights up until my arms start hurting, and then out of that pain, I know I'm going to get something. This is different. This is deeper. This is bigger. This is more real. This is Christian suffering. When I suffer as a Christian, like a Christian should, facing the hardships that Christians face, then glory comes that lasts for an eternity. I'm not just talking about pain and gain. And this also isn't one of these pie-in-the-sky Christian notions that says, okay, one of these days, we're all going to be happy up in heaven. We'll all be stringing our harps and sitting on clouds, and yeah, it'll all be fine. No, this is now. This is earthy. I'm going to show you, for anyone who knows Jesus and knows what he taught and knows how he lived, you know that this principle right here is his life. This principle is as earthy as Jesus himself was. And to get it, go back to verse 8, and let's finish up the chapter. Verse 8, Paul says, we are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. See, in those first 11 verses, Paul shows us that he is embracing his suffering. Because even though he's facing it, it's not defeating him. Even though it's hurting him, it's not killing him. It's not stopping him. It's not completely taking him off the radar. And to understand verses 10 and 11 in particular, you have to put them in a parallel structure. So I want to show you that up on the screen here. Take a look at this. Just to simplify what's going on in these verses, Paul says, we always carry the death of Jesus so the life of Jesus may be revealed in our body. And then in verse 11, he says, we're always being given over to death so that his life may be revealed in our body. You notice that the right half is the same in both places. The right half is the same. It's a parallel structure. Hebrew people and Greek people would use this structure all the time. And what it means is the stuff on the left is also to be considered equivalent or similar or restatement of the same idea. So when Paul says he's carrying the death of Jesus, he means by that, I'm being given over to death regularly. This is the Paul who faced gladiatorial style combats of ancient Rome. This is the Paul where that threat was on his head all the time, where people would flog him, where people would stone him, where people would ridicule him, where he would face shipwreck, all this stuff. Paul says, I am daily being given over to death. That means I've got death around me. It's like he's strapped on an electric chair and he's walking around with it and he just keeps finding places to plug it in. So he's always ready. He says, I'm always being given over to death. I'm always on death's door. I'm always on the verge of leaving this world. But he's not dead yet. How long can you skirt death before you actually cross the line? 5 times, 39 lashes. Once stoned, shipwrecked, all that stuff. He's still not dead. And you know why? He says, it's because the life of Jesus is in me. There's something really, really profound about this. Back in Galatians 2:20, we studied it a couple weeks ago. Paul said, I'm crucified with Christ. I no longer live. Jesus Christ lives in me. Paul believes with all his heart that the life he lives is not because he's breathing, is not because he's eating, but it's because the Spirit of God is directly sustaining him. And the more often he faces death, the more often he realizes the life of Jesus. Christian suffering leads to glory. And you know one of the ways it leads to glory? You get more Jesus. There's another thing. Write that one down. You get more Jesus. If you walk through suffering in a Christian kind of way, you get more Jesus. You experience him more in your life. But if we keep reading, look at verse 12. In verse 12, he says, so then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. He's saying that a little death in him is bringing life to other people. That's salt. That's light. Keep going. He says, it's written, I believe, therefore I've spoken. And with that same spirit of faith, we also believe and therefore speak. Because we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus from the dead will also raise us with Jesus and present us with you in his presence. Present us with you. One of these days, Jesus is coming back. He's going to raise us to life again. So even if I do die, I'm going to be raised to life again. But you know what else? So will you. And we'll all be together, Paul is saying. We'll all be together in that. And then finally, keep going. He says, all this is for your benefit. Paul's saying everything he's doing is so that these other people get the benefit. Every time he suffers, he's doing it for you, for them, because of Jesus. That's what he's saying. He suffers, they get blessed. Christian suffering always leads to glory, and here's one more way. Others get more Jesus. Other people get more Jesus. Then last little piece here in verse 15. He says, all of this is for your benefit so that the grace that is reaching more and more people, all these other people getting more Jesus, the grace that is reaching more and more people may cause thanksgiving to overflow to the glory of God. Write down this last one. Christian suffering leads to glory, and God gets more worship. God gets more worship. He gets more thanksgiving. He gets more glory. God gets more. That's why this is such a hard lesson. Because we want more. And it's okay for us to say we want more Jesus, but God gets more glory. He gets more recognition. He gets more worship. There's a part of our souls that says this. I don't know if you've actually thought this consciously, but there's a part of our souls that says this. I own my life. And so I'm going to someday give my life to Jesus. I'm going to go ahead and pray that prayer. Jesus, would you come into my heart? By the way, it's my heart, but you can come in. Jesus, I want you to take my life. I want you to lead me. I want you to be my Lord. We've said those things. But what we really mean is that we want God to be the manager over our business. So I'm the owner of my life. This is my business. This is my company. And I'm going to hire God as my general manager. And he can make whatever changes he wants to make just so long as I get final veto power. And then if he doesn't perform up to snuff, I can fire him and I can find another manager at some point in time. Because we often say words like this, God, why did you let that happen? As if we're interrogating him. As if he's the one who has to answer to us. When the reality is, it's far different. I don't own me. You don't own you. God's the one who made light shine out of darkness. God's the one who created this universe. He's the one who is, by the way, God. And we are not. So he's the owner. We're barely managers. He's the owner. And he gets all the glory he wants, and that's okay, and that's good. Because the more glory that he gets, the more the rest of this world realizes who it is in relationship to him. And therefore, if we know who we are in relationship to our Maker, our lives are better. Yes, that's a good thing. We experience more joy, but that's not the point. The point is that he gets more glory. And it's just amazing that he would put his light into you and into me. I'm a jar made from mud. And his light is in me. And if I get cracked, and if I get broken, his light still shines out. I'm made from dirt, and his salt is in me. And if I get dissolved, his salt still does its work. Christian suffering leads to glory. I've got a video I want to show you. And this is a video of something that you've never been through, most likely. I'm going to show it to you. I'll come right back up here for a couple closing words to prepare our hearts for communion. But check this out. Watching that, there's a part of me that wants to feel pity and sadness. And perhaps you'd find yourself in that same place too, where you're thinking to yourself, why? Why do such bad things happen to people whose hearts are so strong with God? But I could turn the question around and ask it differently, and I could say, were any of you inspired to live more strongly with the things that you're facing? To live with more faithful endurance regarding the stuff that you're going through? Yeah, I imagine you were. You'd be hard-pressed for any one of us to say, no, that wasn't inspiring, that wasn't motivating. And yeah, we can ask all kinds of analytical questions. Why would God allow that kind of bad stuff to happen in people? It's because they're salt. It's because they're light. And it's because Christian suffering leads to glory. The man on the couch, the father in the story, runs a ministry at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis where he is helping hundreds of other men understand how to raise their children of disabilities better. He is blessing hundreds of people regularly, and now maybe even millions, through the testimony of him and his life. Yeah, you've never been through that. Maybe someone you know has been through something similar, but nothing like that. Nothing like what the Apostle Paul ever had to face. But I want to just draw this to a close with you with just a couple practical questions. See, we can think of the big drastic sufferings, but you face minor hardships all the time. And we don't deal with it very well. Let me just ask you, has someone ticked you off? Has someone cursed at your face? Has someone called you a name? Has someone treated you unfairly? Has someone stabbed you in the back? Has someone cut you off in traffic? Really? And that upset you? Have you ever been flogged? Have you ever been stoned? Has anyone ever tried to kill you and then leave you for dead because of your faith in Jesus? Have you ever been thrown in prison? No? Well, then all I can say to you is what I say to me. Let's get over it. Get over it. Is it hard to bless people who've hurt you? Yes. It's difficult. It's painful. But Christian suffering leads to glory. Is it hard to give yourself again to someone who has failed you time and time in the past? Yes. But Christian suffering leads to glory. Is it hard to keep your cool when someone yells at you? Yes. But Christian suffering leads to glory. Is it hard to bless other people when you're in the midst of tragedy? Yes. But Christian suffering leads to glory. Because your Savior suffered for you. Today, all I want to give you as a challenge is to embrace those moments where a tiny part of you has to die. Because your Savior gave his entire self to death for you. And because the Apostle Paul knew that facing death regularly is something that led to glory for you and for me who get to benefit from what he wrote.